This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. If there is ever a zombie attack, the person most likely to survive just might be my guest Max Brooks, who's the son of Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft. Max Brooks is the author of The Zombie Survival Guide and World War Z, An Oral History of the Zombie Wars. These books are fictional manifestations of his own fears and anxieties and his impulse to overcome them by preparing for the worst. He's done so much research on preparing for widespread catastrophe that he's been invited to participate in an Army WMD preparedness exercise. And he's now a fellow at the Modern War Institute at West Point. He's also very funny, in spite of all the doomsday scenarios he's preoccupied with. His new novel, Minecraft, The Island, is a novelization of the incredibly popular video game Minecraft. Max Brooks, welcome to Fresh Air. Describe the premise of Minecraft, The Island.
Minecraft, The Island is a novel based on the video game Minecraft. Minecraft, the game, for anyone who hasn't played it or who has children and has not asked them, what are you doing on the iPad? It is not so much a game in the literal form, because there's not really a goal except to survive. It is a virtual world of blocks where you literally have to not starve and build a house and not get killed by creatures who come out after dark. And that is really the premise of this book, where someone from our world wakes up in that world and swims to an island and has to survive on the island. So it's like the movie Tron meets Robinson Crusoe. And as this person is surviving and doing basic life skills, they are learning real life skills of wisdom, patience, planning, preparation, how to deal with failure, how to learn from your mistakes, lessons they can take back to their world.
So this book, the Minecraft book and your zombie books, are about surviving when the old rules no longer apply. And your zombies were infected by a virus, the Selenium virus, that spread through contact with body fluids. And you've said that that was partly inspired by the AIDS epidemic. How old were you when you first heard about AIDS?
I think I must have been about 12. I was literally coming into puberty just when I was told that puberty could kill me.
What effect did that have on you?
Well, I think I would be lying if I said that it made me neurotic, but I think it would be pretty accurate.
You were already
Yes, the fire was smoldering, but I think this was the super tanker that exploded onto the smoldering flame that was my genetic neurosis.
And the fact that you write zombie books and the Minecraft book that's all about being in this kind of alien environment and your only goal is to survive. Does that describe what your inner psychological state was like when you were growing
up? Yeah, I think you nailed it. I think the notion of learning how to survive when the old world rules no longer apply, it pretty much sums up everything I write about. It's really the crux of my work. I write a lot about change. And I write about my characters having to adapt to external changes that they did not choose and do not necessarily want.
So what are some of the other external changes you had to navigate through during your formative years?
Well, I think there's the standard one of leaving home. And I think it's pretty much happened to most 18 to 20-something year olds when they go out into the world and they realize that perhaps everything they learned in their house doesn't apply to the outside world and they have to write a whole new rule book. And I think that that has pretty much gone into hyperdrive now, or as my father would say, ludicrous speed, because the world is changing so quickly now that pretty much everything I've learned as a parent is useless to my child. And so the notion of it's not what you learn, but it's how you learn, I think, is the only way you can parent nowadays.
Did the fact that your parents, Anne Bancroft and Mel Brooks, were famous, they had money, give you any sense of security?
Oh, God, no. No. As a matter of fact, that worked against us because my parents were a generation removed. I'm a Gen Xer, and most Gen Xers had baby boomer parents. So most Gen Xers experienced sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and their parents experienced sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It was just a different version of it. Whereas my parents was Hitler and the Depression.
And World War II, because your father fought in World War II.
Yes, my father actually fought against Hitler. And so, for example, my mother's greatest event of her adolescence was not kissing a boy or going to the prom. It was going to the movies with her sisters, and suddenly the movie stopped, and somebody came out onto the stage and said, "We regret to inform you the Japanese have bombed Pearl Harbor. We are now at war."
So between the Holocaust and your mother's experience of World War II, not to mention the Depression, you brought up thinking that at any moment the apocalypse could happen.
Well, I think growing up in Los Angeles in the 1980s was pretty apocalyptic because, you know, if you remember, the 80s tried to very much emulate the 50s, except for things like crack and AIDS and gangs. We did have the good old 1950s resurgence of nuclear war fear. Remember The Day After? That was fun. We had that great miniseries The Day After that kids were told not to watch. And also specifically living in Los Angeles is always on the edge of the apocalypse. We've had constant fires, floods, zero infrastructure. I grew up watching my friends' houses slide down the hills into the canyons. I watched the hills just burn up.
I think you left out earthquakes.
Oh, yes, those too. And that was pretty formative for my zombie work, because really my zombie work is just disaster preparedness. My mother had an earthquake kit, and we would have to go through it, and we would have to train for it, and we would have to have earthquake drills. And my mother talked about if there was an earthquake, we would eat the dog. So
seriously?
We always had, yes, oh yes. I brought my beautiful young girlfriend over, who's now my wife, to dinner with my parents, and the Northridge quake had happened. And we discussed what we would do. And I was saying, well, maybe we could eat the fish in the koi pond. And so my mother had to, of course, one-up me and say, well, we could always eat Purdy. And that was our dog.
So you did a lot of research for the zombie books and the Minecraft book to see what kinds of things you could do to survive. Did you apply any of those from your own life? Or did any of those come from your own life?
Everything I do is based on research. My hero is not James Joyce, it's Tom Clancy. Because as a kid growing up with dyslexia, I loved being able to learn from my fiction. So I loved setting down a book I had read and feeling educated as well as entertained. So everything I do has to be based in reality. And in the Zombie Survival Guide, half of it is book learned and half of it is life learned. When I talk about the M16 being a horrible jamming weapon, that's based on my own personal experience in Army ROTC. And I can tell you as a fact, the M16 was never meant to be a frontline infantry combat weapon. It was meant to be an Air Force base security weapon. So mud, dirt, and suddenly click and jam, and it blows up in your face.
Okay, I'm going to quote two things from your zombie book. These are like takeaway lessons. One is, fear can be conquered, anxiety must be endured. That's actually very funny.
That's very true. That's from Minecraft the Island, where the character on this island realizes that fear represents an actual threat. Fear is a threat you can actually face, conquer, you can be proactive and deal with it. But anxiety is the threat of the threat. Anxiety is thinking about the threat.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's really no way to conquer anxiety except just to get through it and go on about your life. And that's a philosophy I live with.
Okay, so one more. Panic drowns thought. So true. So how have you dealt with anxiety and panic in your life?
Well, I have a lot of experience in that. My family really are refugees from the land of panic, because that's been the philosophy in my family. I don't know if you remember this movie, History of the World.
Oh, yeah, I love it.
Where the refugees they're trying to get out of Rome, and my father's character says, "Don't panic, don't panic, don't panic." And then the legionary goes, "There they are." And then he just says, "Panic!" Welcome to my childhood. We always had these moments, you know, because also remember, my parents went into the fame bubble in their early 20s, late teens, in the late 1940s. And America went through such drastic changes that they really had no coping mechanisms for the modern world of crime, drugs, social disintegration. I mean, the notion that John Lennon could be shot by somebody who loved him, that was incomprehensible when they were kids.
No, it's interesting to me that you've actually worked with the military on preparedness, and it's kind of amazing that they'd be turning to the zombie fiction writer guy to help them in preparing for biochemical and nuclear attacks. So what is or has your role been?
My role has been to work with an organization called the Modern War Institute, which is a think tank located at West Point. And what we do is study modern conflict. And what I do within the Modern War Institute is try to identify military threats in a non-military forum. For example, I wrote an article on Monsanto, where everyone is so worried about GMOs as far as the health concerns, but I looked at GMOs from a geostrategic concern. Last year, Monsanto was sold to Bayer. Now, Monsanto, because of the 2014 Supreme Court decision, has patented the genes, the rights, for 90% of our soybeans and 80% of our corn, which means that farmers, for the first time since the agricultural revolution, cannot buy their seeds. They have to buy their seeds every year. They cannot bank their seeds and replant them. They have to go back to Monsanto every year. Now, that was bad enough when Monsanto was American. And even though we have treaties, security treaties with the Germans, with Bayer, there is nothing to stop that German company from selling it to China. And so theoretically now, legally, China could blackmail us with food, the same way OPEC blackmailed us with oil in the 1970s.
Wow, I'd certainly never heard of or thought of that.
No, what I do is I look at all the pieces that everyone else already has in front of them, but I see them arranged in a certain fashion. And that is, I think, probably because of neurosis, but I think it's probably also because of dyslexia, because I've never been able to learn in a linear fashion. I've had to dig deep and truly understand the subjects that I'm tackling if I'm ever going to get past them. And so it allows me to see avenues that other people might have missed.
How did the military get on to you? What made them think that you were going to be a valuable player in preparedness training?
It all started on a risk where the president of the United States Naval War College asked me to come in and give a talk. I came in and I spoke on interconnectivity. And I talked about how in the 1940s, we understood as a nation that everything was connected. We understood that nutrition, education, infrastructure, all trickled down to national defense. For example, you know how we built our highways. We built our national highway system literally because in case our air bases got nuked, we would have millions of miles of paved runways for our planes to land. We talked about how nutrition meant that our soldiers would be healthy. Education, our soldiers would understand their training. And I talked about how we had lost all that and that the military was in its own little bubble and that everything else was eroding on the other side. And from that lecture, I was invited to speak again and again and again until finally I was at a strategic studies group and I gave that lecture and I gave it a final button. And I said, you better take care of your veterans in this war because my generation grew up with the streets literally paved with Vietnam veterans. And we don't care how many commercials you throw at us. When you see a legless drug addict in a cardboard box wearing an old Vietnam Army jacket, you know that that's what is waiting for you if you serve your country. And if you don't take care of our vets, you'll never get new soldiers. In the back of the room was a young Army captain who just got back from Iraq hearing me talk. And when he was invited to start the Modern War Institute, be one of the founders, he invited me to come along.
My guest is Max Brooks. His new novel is Minecraft, The Island. After a break, we'll talk about growing up with his parents, Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross, back with Max Brooks, the author of the bestsellers The Zombie Survival Guide and World War Z, An Oral History of the Zombie Wars. His new book, Minecraft, The Island, is a novelization of the popular video game Minecraft. His novels are manifestations of the fears he grew up with about AIDS, gangs, earthquakes, nuclear war. In order to write his fictional stories, he's done a lot of research on how to survive a disaster. So much research that he was invited to participate in an Army WMD preparedness exercise, and he's now a fellow at West Point's Modern War Institute. So you grew up with Anne Bancroft and Mel Brooks as your parents. Two very famous, very acclaimed people in the movie business. Did your father test out jokes or story ideas on you when you were young?
Absolutely not. My father came from a generation where if you put a roof over your head and food on the table, you're father of the year. My father yeah. also, you know, my dad didn't also have a dad. My father's father died of tuberculosis when my father was 2 years old. So this sort of new agey notion that a dad is also a pal, that was not in my house. What I did get from my father was stability. And I'm very grateful for that because as a lot of my Gen Xer colleagues will tell you, their baby boomer parents were not home, were out partying, were getting divorce after divorce, were coming home with new girlfriends and just saying, hey, this is your new mom, I think. Whereas my father was home every night at 7 o'clock with my mother and having dinner, and we had a stable life, which I think sort of set the tone for my life in that my wife and I have dinner with our child at home at a certain time every day. And then my dad shows up.
Did you think your father's films were funny?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. No, my dad's films. And the truth is, I always say to people, my father wasn't always funny. You know, I would have to say that 70-80% of the time, he didn't come home as Mr. Funny Man. He came home as this very stressed, overworked man, self-made man who'd risen himself out of extreme poverty and had built an empire of comedy and was trying to maintain that in an ever-changing world of morphing tastes. Mm-hmm. And so I saw the stress, I saw the panic, I saw the man who was watching studio heads change and friends die off and the economics of show business change and him always trying to stay one step ahead. That's what I saw. And I think that was I'm glad I had that. I would much rather have that because that taught me that no matter how easy it looks on the screen, it's a job and it is no easier than any other job. And I was very, very lucky when we did the audiobook of Minecraft the Island. We had two different readers, a man and a woman, Samira Wiley from Orange is the New Black and Handmaid's Tale. She read an amazing version of Minecraft the Island. And the male was a guy I went to high school with, Jack Black.
You went to high school with him? Oh, wow.
I went to high school with Jack. We were in a school play together. And so he agreed to read the male version of Minecraft the Island. So we went to the studio, me and my son, who loves him, loves Kung Fu Panda. Now, Jack was struggling because, in his words, he's a little bit dyslexic and his tongue is too big for his mouth. So it was a priceless teaching moment for my son to watch his hero have to keep going, have to do take after take until he got it right. And then once he's pleased, the audio engineer has to please himself and say, no, I can do that better. And to say to my son, you see, this is a job. This isn't just all happy, fun talent time. Talent is 10%. And so watching Jack Black for my son was a little bit like me watching my father have to grind it out over the course of my childhood.
Mm-hmm. And so what about your mother, Anne Bancroft? She was a great actress. And like The Miracle Worker and The Graduate were such formative films for so many people in such different ways. You know, she's this incredibly patient, wise teacher teaching Helen Keller in The Miracle Worker. And in The Graduate, of course, she's having an affair with somebody who just graduated college and is actually the boyfriend of her daughter. So, you know, the classic Mrs. Robinson. What impact did those films have on you, seeing your mother in both of those roles?
Well, I would tell you that as far as The Graduate goes, I didn't see it until I was about 22 years old because I was afraid. I thought, oh, my God, what if I... Because my whole life, creepy baby boomers had been coming up to me and saying, you know, oh, your mother, first time I saw her, hey, oi, hey. And so I thought, oh, my God, what if it's this weird psychosexual experience that you can't escape from? And what if I see and I get aroused? I'll be on the therapist couch the rest of my life. I'll never have a normal relationship. And so finally, as a tradition where I went to college, they watched The Graduate. And I thought, oh, boy, here we go. And I watched it and I thought, oh, this is it? Wow, you baby boomers must have been repressed. But then as far as you said, The Miracle Worker, well, she was my miracle worker. Because,
in what respect?
Well, because I had dyslexia. And dyslexia in the late 70s, 1980s was unheard of. Dyslexia was they didn't even call it a disability back then. It was just laziness, goofing off. You're not trying hard enough. You can do it, but you don't want to do it. That was a big one of my teachers. And my mother, one of the greatest, most successful actresses of her day, gave up her career, put her career on the shelf to raise me and to be my educational advocate and to teach herself about dyslexia and to come up with coping mechanisms and to meet with my teachers every year and make sure that they understood what I was going through and find ways I could learn in a non-traditional format. She took every year all of my school books that I had to read to the Institute for the Blind and had them all read onto audio cassette so I could listen to my reading list. And if I hadn't been able to do that, I wouldn't have graduated high school. I can literally say that not only did my mother give me my life, she saved my life.
It must have been really hard to watch your father survive the loss of your mother. I'm talking
about, it was terrifying.
Like, resilience. Yeah.
Oh, my God. You want to talk about resilience? Well, you know, we all got lucky. I did, my wife, my father, because we had a little baby. My son was born 2 months before my mother died. So he gave us a purpose. You know, we had this brand new life that this little micro village of the Brooks family had to sort of come around and keep alive with very simple needs, feeding, clothing, sleeping, health, burping. And we could all do that. And I think that saved all of us. You know, it certainly saved my dad. The baby, he would come over and the baby would be in his lap and he would fall asleep on the couch with the baby. The two of them would sleep on the couch together. And he would walk the baby around until he burped and he would entertain him. And to this day, my father and my son have this amazing relationship. My father comes over every night and my son can't wait. You know, my wife and I, not every night. Once in a while, it'd be nice to get a break, but my son, he's like, oh, grandpa, grandpa, come on. And they love each other. And my son is irreverent, just like my father. And now my father has this protege. And so when my son was pretending to be FDR in his Notable Americans class, he goes, hey, Dad, can I do FDR, a polio comedy? I said, no, you can't do that. And my father said, what? That's hilarious. No one's ever done that. FDR, a polio comedy. You'll love it.
Max Brooks, thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been amazing to hear what you have to say.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Max Brooks has a new novel, Minecraft the Island. It's inspired by the video game Minecraft. This is Fresh Air Weekend. Laura Shapiro is a celebrated food historian and writer who's published books and articles on subjects ranging from Julia Child to Jell-O. Shapiro's latest book is called What She Ate, and our book critic Maureen Corrigan says that after reading it, she's already hungry for more.
Back in the late 1980s, when I was first starting out as a critic for the Village Voice, one of the books I was assigned was Laura Shapiro's Perfection Salad, a social history of the home economics movement during the turn of the last century. I can't recall many of the other books I reviewed in those days, but Perfection Salad has remained indelibly with me. Shapiro helped break new ground by taking the history of women, housework, and cooking seriously, even as her witty and vivid writing style was decidedly unsolemn. Now, some 30 years later, Shapiro has done it again, this time breaking new ground in the art of biography by taking the adage, "You are what you eat," literally. Shapiro's fascinating new book is called What She Ate, and it focuses on the lives of six women from different centuries and continents, all prominent to different degrees. Among them are Dorothy Wordsworth, the poet's shy, worshipful sister, Eva Braun, Hitler's mistress and 11th hour wife, and Helen Gurley Brown, the whippet-thin, legendary editor-in-chief of Cosmopolitan. All six women have been the subjects of earlier biographies, but as Shapiro points out, biography, as it's traditionally practiced, still tends to honor the old-fashioned custom of keeping a polite distance from food. In contrast, Shapiro likens her method of biographical research to standing in line at the supermarket and peering into the other carts. In the resulting portraits, Shapiro, like a consummate maitre d', sets down plate after plate of the food these women cooked, ate, or thought about. And an amazing thing happens. Slowly, the more familiar accounts of each of their lives recede, and other, messier narratives emerge. As Shapiro says, our food stories don't always honor what's smartest and most dignified about us. More often, they go straight to what's neediest. Take the chapter here on Eleanor Roosevelt, certainly one of the most chronicled women in history. The common wisdom is that food was mere fuel to Eleanor. Shoring up this official story is the fact that Eleanor hired as her White House chef Mrs. Henrietta Nesbitt, whom Shapiro calls the most reviled cook in presidential history. Here's a sampling of the regularly repeated White House luncheon menu, always made from leftovers. There were curried eggs on toast, mushrooms and oysters on toast, broiled kidneys on toast, braised kidneys on toast, chipped beef on toast, and a dish called shrimp wiggle, consisting of shrimp and canned peas heated in white sauce on toast. Shapiro surveys the well-mined trove of Eleanor's letters, memoirs, and newspaper columns and spots a striking pattern. Inside the White House, Eleanor was apathetic about what was on her plate. Outside, she discovered the delights of appetite, enthusing, for instance, over the popovers she made for her beloved bodyguard, Earl Miller, in the 1930s, or a delicious Arab dinner she enjoyed in Beirut in 1952. As Eleanor herself said in looking back on her White House years, I had erected someone outside myself who was the president's wife. Shapiro's astute reading of Eleanor's food trail testifies to Eleanor's distaste for that official role. The Ava Braun chapter here is practically the insane inverse of Eleanor's, and every bit as illuminating. Since Braun's existence as Hitler's mistress was kept secret from the public, she gloried in her private and very feminine role as hostess of the meals at Hitler's mountain retreat, where high-ranking Nazis feasted on the righteousness of their cause. Shapiro opens Braun's life story with its chilling end. Late April 1945, when she and Hitler were hiding in the Berlin bunker where they would commit suicide. Braun welcomed architect Albert Speer to the bunker for a frantic goodbye visit. And as he recalled in his memoir, Braun, ever the enthusiastic hostess, radiated an almost gay serenity. How about a bottle of champagne for our farewell? Braun asked. And some sweets? I'm sure you haven't eaten in a long time. As Shapiro says, the guilt-free zone in the heart of Hitlerdom that Braun helped create through gourmet meals held fast to the very end. Several times throughout What She Ate, Shapiro repeats what surely is one of her life's mantras. Food talks, but somebody has to hear it. How lucky for us readers that Laura Shapiro has been listening so perceptively for decades to the language of food.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed What She Ate by food historian Laura Shapiro. Coming up, poet Molly McCulley Brown talks about poetry, faith, and disability. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. During the first half of the 20th century, many people in Virginia deemed mentally or physically defective were confined in the Virginia state colony for epileptics and feeble-minded, a government-run residential hospital where they were sterilized to prevent them from creating more people like themselves. The facility is now dedicated to training the cognitively impaired. My guest, poet Molly McCulley Brown, was born in 1991, grew up near this facility, and often wondered if she would have been deemed defective and confined in the colony had she been born a few decades earlier. She has cerebral palsy, a neurological disorder that affects body movement and muscle coordination. Her new collection of poems, The Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded, imagines what life was like in the colony. The poems were described in a New York Times book review as part history lesson, part seance, part ode to dread, beautiful and devastating. As the daughter of two novelists, she grew up immersed in books. As we'll discuss later, Molly McCulley Brown converted to Catholicism 3 years ago, although she describes her relationship to the church as uncomfortable. She's at work on a collection of essays about disability, poetry, religion, and the American South. Molly McCulley Brown, welcome to Fresh Air. I love your poems. So how often did you see the former colony for epileptics and feeble-minded when you were driving around your home in Virginia?
You know, I drove by the entrance to the colony practically daily when I was a child and a teenager, but I never went inside of it until I was in college and home in Virginia from California for the summer and starting to think about the Virginia landscape. And I took a kind of impromptu trip inside with a friend. So I'd driven by this place. I'd known about it for years and years, for my whole conscious life, basically, but I'd never seen it up until that point.
What feeling did you get when you were inside?
It was incredibly moving and incredibly powerful. The place is interesting because it is still an operational facility for adults with really serious disabilities, although it is in the process of closing. But like a lot of things in Virginia, it was initially built on an enormous amount of land. And so a really interesting thing happened, which is that as the buildings that were originally part of the colony fell into disrepair, they were largely just moved out of and new buildings were built on accompanying land. But those original buildings were not necessarily torn down. And so the place itself is this really strange combination of functioning facility and ghost town of everything that it has been. And so I've never been in a place that felt more acutely haunted in my life.
So I'd like you to read an excerpt of the opening poem from your book. This is the part of the poem where you're driving past the building that used to be the state colony for epileptics and feeble-minded. You're driving past it and you're thinking about the people who live there. You're thinking about what their lives have been like. And in this second part, you're also thinking about what it might have been like had you been forced to live there, as you might have been if you were born just a few decades earlier. Mm-hmm. Would you read it for us?
Sure. I am my own kind of damaged there, looking out the right-hand window, spastic, palsied, and off balance. I'm taking crooked notes about this place. It is the land where he is buried, the place she spent her whole life, the room where they made it impossible for her to have children. It is the colony where he did not learn to read, but did paint every single slat of fence you see that shade of yellow. The place she didn't want to leave when she finally could, because she'd lived there 50 years and couldn't drive a car or remember the outside or trust anyone to touch her gently. And by some accident of luck or grace, some window less than half a century wide, it is my backyard, but not what happened to my body.
Do you think you would have been sent there had you been born decades earlier?
I mean, it is impossible to know that for sure, you know, and I can look at my life and look at my family and look at my parents and think, you know, no, never, that never would have happened. But I also understand that if I'd been born 50 years earlier, the climate was very different. The understanding of disability was very different. And what happened to people who were born with severe disabilities was a very different thing. And I think it is certainly a possibility. And that possibility is absolutely one of the things that led me to write the book.
So when you were growing up with cerebral palsy, what were the assumptions made about you and your cognitive abilities when you were a child?
You know, I feel very lucky that I grew up with parents who were phenomenal and fierce and insistent advocates for me, and so who never let anyone assume that I was less cognitively capable or really less capable in any significant way because I had cerebral palsy and my mobility was compromised. And they were wonderful about making sure that I was mainstreamed in the public school system as a child and had access to all the right kinds of educational opportunities. But with that said, I think we do have strange tendency in this country to equate any kind of disability with less intellectual capability and with even a kind of less complete humanity. And so I certainly, as a child and as a teenager and even now as an adult, encountered people who assumed that just because I used a wheelchair, maybe I couldn't even speak to them. I often get questions directed at people that I'm with as opposed to me. And that's a really interesting phenomenon.
So the assumption that some of your poems are based on is not only were the people in this colony considered unfit to reproduce, therefore they were sterilized. It was assumed in some ways that they were like the outcasts of God, and that's why they were quote, defective. So you have several poems that relate to faith and religion and the people who are living in this colony. And I'd like you to read one of those poems. It's called The Convulsions Choir. And this is I'm going to ask you to read an excerpt of that poem. Would you introduce it for us?
Sure. So this poem is called The Convulsions Choir, and it's from the point of view of an imagined colony patient who is epileptic. And I'm just going to read the very first part of the poem, which takes place in the colony's chapel. They did not build the church for us. I overheard one night nurse talking to another. They meant it for the staff, as a refuge from the stench, the idiot, and the insane. They meant, you will need God more than ever in this place. After all, we are a whole host of reasons to stop believing in anything. I am the worst thing the reasoned world has wrought.
Is that poem based on things that you learned in researching the colony, that the church was really built for the staff and not for the people who were permanent residents of the colony?
I don't know that I ever came upon a sort of direct statement of that fact. But what I did come upon again and again was a kind of understanding that was pervasive in the colony and in the eugenics movement in the 30s at the time that these poems are set, that the people who were colony patients, colony inmates, were somehow subhuman, somehow not fully possessed of meaningful inner lives and meaningful consciousnesses that were developed to the same extent as, you know, somebody who was considered not defective by the times of society at that moment might have been. And from there, it felt like a really kind of easy conclusion for me to imagine that these spaces, which are about the kind of cultivation of one's inner life, of one's soul, if you want to call it that, of one's relationship with whatever higher power one might believe in, couldn't have and wouldn't have been imagined for these patients, but did exist on colony grounds. And so from there, I kind of extrapolated to this point where I tried to imagine, okay, if you don't really believe that these patients are possessed of a complete inner life and are possessed of a sort of capacity to be concerned with their own soul, then who are you building a church for here and why?
You have another poem that's written from the perspective of a priest or a minister at the church in the colony. And I'd like you to read an excerpt of that one for us. And to introduce it as well.
Yeah, so it was important to me in writing the book that I tried to imagine not just the perspectives of women who would have been colony patients, but also people who might have and would have worked there. And so this is one of those poems, as you said, from the perspective of a preacher, a minister who works at the colony, trying to kind of grapple with his own relationship to the place and the people and the work that he was doing there. And I'm just going to read the first two sections. Prayer for the wretched among us. One. Always they tell you to go where God calls you. What they don't say is that sometimes God will call you to the wilderness, gesture toward the trees, and then hang back and wave you on alone. This is how I wound up granting absolution to low-grade idiots and the worn-out women who turn them over in bed at night and at dawn go home to their own families, try not to think of ghosts wasting away in the world. Two. You are not supposed to be afraid of sinners. You should take off your shoes and give them to the wretched and the damned. Hold out your hand to every girl, even if she seems more animal, statue, or remnant of plague than lost disciple. But do the children of God really lose their eyes in the backs of their heads and swallow their own tongues in church?
That's Molly McCulley Brown reading one of her poems from her new collection, The Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded. Molly, you converted to Catholicism a few years ago. You know, Christ's body is an essential part of Mass, the wafer and the wine, and Holy Communion is meant to be the body and the blood of Jesus. So I'm wondering if it's significant for you that the body of Jesus is such a part of the Mass, given that your body has been such a defining trait for you your whole life because of its limitations and because of the pain it's caused you and the attention it gets from people who see you, you know, either in a wheelchair or walking with difficulty.
Absolutely. I think one of the central things that drew me to Catholicism in the beginning was how central and significant the body is in the Mass, both in terms of, yes, that understanding that Christ's body is literally present as part of the service, and also in terms of how bodily the Mass is and how bodily the theology is. I think we have this tendency to think of religion as something which is about leaving the body behind, right? You have a soul, you have a spiritual life that is somehow utterly untethered from the fact that you are a flesh and blood person moving around in the world and limited and constituted by your body in all of these unavoidable ways. And one of the things that I find so moving about Catholicism is that it never forgets that to be a person is inherently and inescapably and necessarily to be in a body that brings you pain, a body that brings you pleasure, a body that can be a barrier to thinking more completely about your life and your soul, but that can also be a vehicle to delivering you into better communion with the world, with other people, and to whatever divinity it is that you believe in.
So, Molly, could you tell us just a little bit about your condition of cerebral palsy?
Yeah, so cerebral palsy is a neurological disorder, and the easiest way to describe it is that it's a little bit like a stroke that happens usually in utero or immediately after birth. And one of the most common causes of the type that I have, which is called moderate spastic diplegia, is oxygen deprivation. And it just essentially results in brain damage, which impairs your gross motor control, your balance, and in my case results in heightened spasticity, which means that my muscles are really, really tense and really tight. Cerebral palsy is a big umbrella of a disorder. There are people who have cerebral palsy who are affected so severely that it inhibits their speech, it inhibits the motion of their hands, it means that they can and don't walk at all. And there are people who have CP, which is the abbreviation, who are really pretty mildly affected and might be a little bit clumsy, have a gait that looks, you know, slightly other than what you might typically expect. I fall somewhere in the middle of that spectrum. So I walk with a very crouched gait. My balance is very bad and my endurance is very limited. And that means that I use a wheelchair to walk more than sort of very short distances.
So when you were born, you were very premature.
I was.
How premature?
I was born at 27 weeks, which is almost 3 months premature.
So in one of your essays, you kind of asked the question, when is it appropriate to tell people that you have cerebral palsy, that you're often in a wheelchair? When do you tell a potential employee? When do you tell a potential boyfriend? Like, say you're meeting the person for the first time at a restaurant and you're already seated and that person doesn't necessarily know. Has your opinion about that changed over the years?
Oh, I think my opinion about that changes every 35 seconds based on how it is that I am feeling or who it is that I'm interacting with on a given day. I like to think I'm getting better at navigating the question of disclosure. You know, I'm in this kind of complicated space when it comes to that because obviously the moment that you see me stand up or you see me walk, you know that I'm disabled. It is absolutely sort of visually unavoidable. But you don't necessarily know if you just see me sitting at a desk in a classroom or sitting at a table in a restaurant. And so there is this sort of initial moment of, okay, how do you disclose? What do you do? But, you know, in some ways, I think I'm helped by the fact that that moment can only be a moment because the moment I want to move, I have no choice but to deal with the fact that my body announces that truth about itself to the world. And learning how to grapple with that, learning what to say about it, learning how to navigate people's reactions to it was a sort of process that evolved over the course of my childhood and my adolescence and is still evolving as I'm an adult.
Well, Molly McCauley Brown, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Molly McCauley Brown's new collection of poems is called The Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Teresa Madden, Mooj Zaidi, and Thea Chaloner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. I'm Terry Gross.